in charge we're not sure about.
Okay, and welcome to episode number 38 of the InTech We Trust podcast. We almost have a full house. We have Gabriel.
Hello.
We have Mark.
Hey.
And we have Rickatron.
Now.
So we are just...
You got that, Mark. You got it, eh?
it took a while.
The only one we're missing today is our very best friend, Nigel Poulton, who is apparently somehow... living
king of the caravans.
He's living in a caravan or so. He's in between houses. I think his internet connection in a new house is actually going to be worse than the previous house. So let's see what happens for him in the future. Is there anyone that has an interesting story of what happened to him in the last week?
An interesting story? No. I've been head down all week on... Cisco Live preparations, VMworld preparations, just lots of preparations. It's trade show season. We've got Red Hat Summit coming up. Just a whirlwind of activity.
I mean, I have a little beer news. I mean, I've always got something to talk about with beer. And it's not necessarily good, but I wouldn't call it bad either. So the last time I bottled, I ran out of corn sugar that you normally use for priming sugar to carbonate in the bottles. And so I was with my son. We were trying to figure out what to do. And so we made up what we didn't have in corn sugar with powdered sugar. And the beer has a distinct, I shouldn't say distinct, but it definitely has the mouthfeel of like birthday cake frosting.
What?
So we're kind of calling it birthday beer. Yeah, because powdered sugar has a little bit of cornstarch in it, apparently.
Right.
I did not go to the beer forums until it was too late. And everyone there says, never, ever, ever use powdered sugar for priming sugar. Well, I didn't do the whole thing in powdered sugar. I did some of it. And it definitely has this kind of funky birthday cake mouthfeel to it.
It's your birthday.
Hey, you know, it'll be very drinkable on hot days in the summer.
Okay. Awesome. Rickatron.
Hey, I just triangulated, that's a word, a complex trip since I was last on the podcast. I'm in Ohio in the States, as most of you know, but I jumped over to Palo Alto, and then I jumped over to St. Petersburg, Russia, and then I jumped over to Rome, and now I'm back home. So I was zonked after that long trip, and it's good to be back, but like Gabe, I'll be running down to San Diego next week.
So we promised ourselves to ask you this week, what's your when in Rome from last week?
When in Rome, order the carbonara, that's for sure. That's my recommendation. It's funny because in the States here, the Italian food kind of varies quite a bit. In Europe, Italian restaurants are very close to the flavor, but as they go this way, I had some really good food like la matriciana, carbonara, cacio e pepe. Oh, I love Italian food. And
I love Italian food in Italy.
Yes.
You know. Copy that. Yeah, exactly.
So I remember our first storage field day, and we had both, I think, at least Fabio Raposelli, and I think we had Enrico Signoretti as well at that or it may have been Fabio in at the very least. And we're going to this... this is our favorite Italian restaurant in San Jose with the whole crew, and Fabio didn't touch the food at all. It was so horrible, like stuffed chicken with spinach, and it was not eatable. So both Fabio and I actually didn't eat that well that night, because we know how Italian should taste like.
Yeah, I remember I went around and ate your servings.
Nice.
Okay. I do have something to say about this week, guys. Well, you guys know, of course, but for the listeners, I have very good and a little bit lesser good news. The very good news is that I did find a new challenge.
Woo! HD!
Yeah. It's been a really rough trip in the last, actually, almost 24 months now looking for something. I mean, I've done a couple of small things in the meantime, but I haven't really found a new challenge to go after. Been looking for a while. It was pretty rough search because most of the things I really want to do are in the States. And they hire local people for that. But somehow, by accident, actually, I meet this guy that has a very small startup in Belgium. And I actually never thought about looking for startups in Belgium because the only ones, there's none in our own industry, right? The only ones we have is Amply Data, who is now acquired by HGST a couple of weeks ago, and Karingo is originally from Belgium, but they have two or three people here, and everyone else is state-based. So there's nothing here to really go after in our industry, which means you lose your edge, right? Your added value. And by accident, I meet this guy that has that is building a product in stealth, and they're really working on the technical part, but they have no focus at all on marketing and on what should we do next to building the product. And I'll be joining them for that. We thought last week that nothing was more boring than backup, but hey, I'll be going into monitoring of manufacturing plants.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. Woo! So it's really weird.
Hey, that's the ultimate automation, Hans.
It is. It really, really is. And it's something useful with big data and data lakes and so on. The software type is operational historian, and it's like where a temperature meter of a gas pipeline. That data that goes into this massive database, and then someone, a data scientist, needs to find out the things out of that in these 20 years old data. So that's something that, so they're building something on top of that. Really big data analytics. And it looks nice, but for me, the challenge is it's slightly out of my comfort zone. Everyone always says, well, you have to go outside of your comfort zone. It's going to give a ramp-up time for me, definitely, this time. But the challenge is there. My job will be actually more like VP marketing type, but very small, right? It's the early starts of that. But things I haven't done, so really looking forward. And the lesser news for the podcast is that I...
Wait a minute. We're not done. Claim victory already. Don't say it's a smaller thing. Just... You did
it.
It's already job done.
You didn't know that? Come on.
Yes, now it is. As of this week.
We're saying it. That's what we're talking about.
The loudest.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they have no idea. Yeah, the only thing, what I have been thinking of this week was I will not miss the fights, the online fights, the whole left and right and block was, that's actually not part of that industry. If it happens to become part of the industry, they have no idea what's coming their side.
Maybe you can bring social media into the manufacturing world, and then you can fight online too, just like everyone else.
Yeah, so that's good.
One comment.
So when we have an InTech We Trust party there, we got to have an InTech We Trust party at the office, like some Thursday night.
We might one day.
You know, one thing I did want to comment on what you're doing there is it does really, it holds a lot of relevance to the shape and state of where information technology goes is if you look at the manufacturing processes. I mean, go and read the Phoenix Project, and it's all the lessons that they're drawing are upon the lessons learned over the last 100 years from manufacturing processes and applying those concepts into the IT world and the agility, continuous integration, continued development, all of that lean technologies or lean mindsets are all coming from, you know, Toyota and all in Ford and all these different organizations that built these kind of processes that now IT is finally adopting and implementing to make themselves as equally as efficient as an assembly line of robots. So there's a lot more synergy between, you know, information technology and the future of where it's going with manufacturing than I think a lot of people realize.
Well, what does look a little bit similar to what we have in our industry is the types of a Splunk and all those types of, we do that, the resource management and the monitoring and looking for trends and making stuff better. That's actually more what they will be doing for manufacturing plants. And I've been there for a couple of days and I've already seen a customer working with their existing historian software is what it called, and they're really pulling data out and then putting into Excel. And it's like, okay, I see why this makes sense to do something with that. But so I do need to go a little bit to the lesser good news, is that as of a result of that, I will not have the time to keep doing the show. Yeah. So sorry about that. It's both a little bit out of my focus industry now. It's going to be a totally different industry, which makes it hard to follow the daily news. And secondly, I just won't have the time. These guys are like, oh, you're going to help us? Well, this is the whole list of things we would like you to do. So I will just not have the time to do it. So I wish you guys all the luck of the world with the next episodes. And who knows when I'll be back, right? There's quite a number of people that, when I made it public on my Facebook profile, that said, well, you're an infrastructure guy, you'll be back. So we'll see what happens. The world is small.
I like to say that it's a long road, but a small world. And, you know, you start jumping into different cycles and industries. And, you know, many people don't know this, Hans and friends, but before I came into where I am now, I worked as an engineer for Siemens in the supply chain industry, which was really the automation end of that manufacturing space. And that's when I like to say I did real work. This is an industry that is ripe for the IT Hulk, and we all wish you the best of luck, Hans.
Thanks, guys.
Okay. Tell him, Ricketron, he's going to come crawling back to
yeah,
us.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I bet EMC will acquire D Square, and then we'll all be all set.
Oh, Jesus. No. Hell no. Okay. Let's go and have another show because there is quite some news this week. Actually, there's one thing I do want to come back to of the last weeks. We've been having this LinkedIn discussion about NetApp for over 4 weeks now, and it keeps on giving. Every day there's new people coming, and we are now at 71 comments. This is a hilarious conversation, but it does mean that it's something that triggers people to think and talk about, that there's actual meat on the bone in that. What the hell is NetApp doing? And there's actually one more thing in the news of this week at the end of the show. On this week's tech news, I have two items. Pure Storage had a release of a new array and some programs around it. And secondly, HP is having HP Discovered this week and announced a new 3-PAR series. Has anyone followed the Pure Storage news of this week?
Well, yeah. I followed it. I think a lot of people followed it. There was a lot of discussion on, you know, all over the places they announced. And that's a massive marketing effort. It's like a 50 stop. Vaughn put a post out showing all the different locations, and they're spending a significant amount of money to educate their customer base and educate other potential customers about, you know, what this means with their new platform, right? So they've moved off of their OEM partnership. And now on to their own, you know, their own physical form factors that they've designed from the ground up. You know, obviously working with somebody like a Foxconn or something like that to bring their product to market. And it's an architectural change in certain respects on where, you know, where they use NVMe technologies and what the backplane or internode communications look like. So, you know, this is, I think, Gen 4 of the Pure Storage technologies.
And there was one more thing that is actually new. You say a lot of marketing. They've also started now on the bloggers and influencers program, or they have someone working on that, and they invited us. And I followed the a pre-briefing, so which was also a first to do actually a pre-briefing on a big announcement. I did follow it, but I hadn't that much time to follow in detail afterwards, but I did follow the briefing. I think there were three big items in the news. There were two programs they announced. One of them was a support program. The first one was something with evergreen
yes, storage.
Evergreen. And then the mid section was the new array. One of the questions that was key for me is that you mentioned to Gabriel, they did change the backplane connectivity to the shelves, right? Which was previously InfiniBand, and I asked him, like, well, you've always said you're going to make every component switchable, right? I can just change controllers, I can change shelves. What are you going to do now with these controllers that have a different backend connectivity? And apparently they are going to add InfiniBand connectors in those new nodes if you happen to have old shelves. So it has been thought about, and it's not going to be rip and replace for everything.
So our buddy Chris Evans on his blog, Architecting IT, had a nice write-up of what this is. Nice fast read. He had supposed that the changes in memory had created stateful controllers, but then somebody from Pure came back in a comment and said, no, it's still stateless. So for people that, you know, that want to get a look from somebody that we like to read and talk to, the Chris Evans, Architecting IT, has a nice overview of it. But I have to say, when I went to Pure's site to try to get much about it, I really didn't see much. I saw things inviting me to go see the announcement. It was after it was done, and there wasn't a replay available. So, you know, I couldn't get much off their site, but you know, other people have some stuff. I don't know if anybody else found that. Maybe I'm just being drunk, but Gabriel, you'd mentioned, you know, it's a big marketing effort, but I think they kind of missed the opportunity to actually have more information on their site.
I'm sure Vaughn is one of the people that listens to our podcast as soon as it's published, so he'll pick up on that and make sure you have a video at least privately.
Yeah, no, but it should be public. Maybe they're trying to hold back on it for some reason. They've got these 30 dates that they've got scheduled or whatever. I think the last one's Minneapolis. So I looked at the page. You know, I skimmed mm-hmm. to the bottom. But I think they could have had more stuff there.
Okay, so the second news part, there's probably going to be more news coming out of HPD Discover, was the three-power news series. Is there anything on HP Discover? I think, Rickatron, you have something on Discover or on 3PAR to say?
Not so much on the 3PAR, but on the whole kind of rundown of news. And to be honest, you're right. We probably may see some more news of interest, but honestly, I doubt we're going to see anything of interest. Usually they bring the big stuff up front. First of all, and I'm not happy, new logo. It's not, in my opinion, first of all, a big deal. Second of all, honestly, I like, as Nigel would say, the Hewlett-Packard logo with the H and the P. And this little rack square, I just don't get it. I don't get it.
Oh, yeah, the green rectangle. That was
the floating element, whatever you want to call it.
I think it's
it.
A minus sign.
Nice.
Oh, Mark.
Nice. Or divided by, either way, something on top is better.
H minus P.
Speaking of minus, the one part of interest, effective 1st of November of this year, the printer division will split. That's something that had been rumored, but basically the split, I think it will take printers and such out of the core line of everything else. But don't think that that's kind of like getting rid of something that's not working, folks, because printers and the ink, there is money in that. And a little piece of trivia here. Printer ink is one of the most expensive liquids per gallon or per liter when you add it up. So there is money in that. So that's going to become a different division, which I don't really get. If it's making money, keep it. They might have their own reasons internally, like regional sales, and, you know, one person can sell a 3PAR. Does that sales manager also have to worry about printers? Who knows? The other piece of information that I kind of latched on to was...
I'm just going to stop you there for a second. I think you really hit the nail on the head. It's that printer business is a commodity business of you know, huge distribution business that is quite a bit different than the enterprise business. And having sales guys do both really is a problem, you know, and just having both things go on. It does make sense for them to try to separate it and optimize both businesses. You know, they're probably doing it before some, you know, raider comes in and says, you know, buys up a bunch of stock and says, you have to separate these companies.
I have never heard a single HP person mentioning server storage and printers in the same line or in the same conversation. So you're absolutely right.
Yeah, and if you're a large company, right, when you go all in with a brand, you know, you want to really go all in. My past experience, we would do that with Dell, and, you know, we would complain to one person about the PCs, the servers, the storage, the whatever, right? So if you think about those large enterprise customers, it kind of makes sense for the split, but it's a profitable line of business. This is a split that, you know, you see what happened with Symantec, and maybe it's like kind of a chic thing to split nowadays, but I don't think that their printer business is not profitable. Maybe they're positioning up for a divestiture to sell and make some money off of that. I'm not sure, but
it is, the margins are getting squeezed on it though. They get fewer and less margin every year in their printer business.
That's true. And there's you know, a whole bunch of, especially the ink, which is the recurring revenue. There's a lot of aftermarket refills and generic brand equivalents. But, you know, to the listeners, and if you guys don't know, by the way, one of my side projects is that I guest blog at addictedtocosco.com. And last month or 2 months ago, they had a special on a printer. I don't know if you guys have had to purchase a new home printer. You should really check out all of the features. Like, you can print on your phone, you can print on your iPad, all that stuff easy. Wi-Fi, cards, all kinds of stuff. If you need a new printer, or if your current printer sucks, you really should look at the new printers. I was really shocked at, for the money, what you could buy for a new home printer. It was really impressive. So you guys might check that out.
I have this. I have an HP multifunctional, and it works from every device, every iPhone, iPad, tablet, whatever, scanning, double-sided. It's really good stuff.
Yeah, there's good innovation for the space.
Yes.
It's just, I can understand for HP, you know, for maybe where Meg wants to take it, it probably makes sense to focus on the data center.
Hey, so Rigatron, HP actually was the first real big third-party vendor to have a real plug-in together with Veeam. Was there anything with the snapshot technology? Was there any news regarding Veeam at HP Discover, or is it just same old thing? No real news features or so.
No, we don't have any news aligning to the event.
Okay,
you know.
Okay,
yeah.
It was a vested partnership already.
Yeah, they were maybe first. Maybe later, but not now.
Yeah, I did hear that apparently in 9. So you added, you started with HP 3-part left hand, added some NetApp stuff, and now EMC is apparently. Is it a rumor or is that official?
Oh, no, that's official. VNX and VNXE are coming later in the year. So we're playing the market. Wish us luck.
Okay, we'll see. Hey, guys, let's move to biz news. Actually, the HP stuff, a lot of it was already biz news. We have a couple of acquisitions that are interesting and a couple of people moving around. Let's start with all the acquisitions. Two big acquisitions in the chip market. Let's start with Intel buying Altera, and another one that, which is interesting, is Avago buying Broadcom. How much do we want to say about the Intel buying Altera? Who knows anything about that? That is interesting enough for the show.
I mean, Altera is a massive chip manufacturer. They make a lot of FPGAs. They've done a lot of work around 10 gig Ethernet and other high speed connectivity, as well as, you know, chips that go into all the little devices that we have. And, you know, I guarantee you their stuff is sitting in some piece of equipment in your house. I mean, you probably say the same thing for Broadcom, too. But what you're seeing is a consolidation of, you know, because there's such a thrust on mobile and there's such a thrust on, you know, I think the overhyped Internet of Things, chip technologies, you know, they need some other divestiture other than just going into phones and going into computers. And Intel and Avago are looking to be the leaders in that space because it's substantial in terms of what the potential to address total addressable market is. My 2 cents.
Well, what I had heard was that most of Altera's products are actually server-oriented products, that they don't have a big mobile business. And so the effect on Intel stock was to drop because the investors did not see this as an expansion or as an attempt by Intel to get back in the mobile space. I mean, you look at mobile and Microsoft, not mobile and Microsoft, but Intel and Microsoft, two companies that own the desktop, both of them are mostly out of mobile. You know, Microsoft's got a little more because they have applications that run on phones, you know, but the Windows phone, you know, we can talk about that all day. But Intel and Microsoft both missed, and apparently this Altera, some investors believe it is, it does not get Intel closer to the mobile space. So it's a head-scratcher from that respect.
Well, but Intel is leader in the server and storage space.
Absolutely, so. Yeah. So they're bolstering up their, you know, their defenses there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the investors don't get that? The infrastructure space, the enterprise space, they don't get that?
Investors,
is that what you're saying?
Investors don't get infrastructure nearly as well as consumer.
Yeah, I can see where that comes from. I mean, okay, so let's move. Avago buying Broadcom. What does this mean for the market?
Well, this falls on the heels of Avago buying
Emulex.
Yeah.
And what a surprise! I mean, this is really shocking. $37 billion. And Avago or Avago, however you say it, right? That's what's left over from a previous HP spinoff, Agilent. Right, the test and measurement business of HP was split off a decade ago or something like that, maybe longer. And HP went one way and Agilent went the other way. And now you look at what's gone on with Agilent. They're now Avago, and they're buying. They're spending billions and billions of dollars. I don't know where they're getting that money from, but you know it's forcing this kind of stampede. I think that's consolidating the industry.
Are they buying $37 billion in cash?
Well, I don't know. I'm sure it's not cash.
I think it was $17 billion in cash, and then
wow,
a whole bunch
$17
of
in cash. Those wow,
that's a lot of cash, man.
Yeah.
Whoa.
I could use some of that cash.
Hey now.
Yeah.
That would
well,
be.
You should
Mark
have stayed at Emulex.
No, I mean, the Emulex deal was I think they got in for like $6 or $7 a share. It was pretty much within the market price.
That's what Mark calls walking around money.
That was chump change.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, you know, I'm pretty sure I think the Emulex deal was less than $1 billion.
Yeah, so quoting Forbes, Avago will acquire Broadcom for $17 billion in cash and the economic equivalent of $140 million Avago ordinary shares valued at $20 billion as of close of business May 27. That is some coin.
Yeah, and if you're a salesperson for either one of those companies, you know, you are sharpening your knives and doing everything right now because it's going to be a bloodbath.
Yeah, definitely.
From what I've heard, Avago does tend to go in there and make their adjustment post-acquisition.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. You can't have that duplication.
Can't absorb, you know, a company the size of Broadcom and not have to pare back some of it, you know. And I'd be curious from a standpoint of, you know, what does the branding look like going forward? I mean, Broadcom's a fairly well-known name. I just turning it into Avago, you know, there's all kinds of challenges around that. I think the dynamics of large company mergers are actually pretty fascinating when you look at, you know, how they want to turn around and spin that going to market. Because, I mean, can you really just take the Broadcom name and dissipate it and call it Avago? Or is it going to be Broadcom powered, or is it Avago powered by Broadcom? How does that discussion look like?
You actually bring up a good point, Gabriel. Is there any conflict of interest with existing customers, like OEM customers of Broadcom? I mean, there's a lot of Broadcom chips in switches and so on. Is there anything that could change the market there? Like we would have a Cisco buying a storage partner that would make issues with other storage partners, right? Is there something that could change here with Avago buying Broadcom?
You know,
I don't think so, right?
I'm not that aligned to the space as much anymore, but I can't think of anything off the top of my head that would, you know, be a conflict for them.
What might happen is the component industry might be a little bit smaller in players, and this new company can really control component costs.
I think we should call it Avabroad.
Have a broad? What?
What'd I say?
I mean, Yeah, apparently they are the ninth largest semiconductor company. That was back in 2014. So with these new purchases, who knows where they're at? Does that put them in the top three?
Oh, yeah. Well.
Or yeah, top three. Certainly top three. One or two, I would say.
Yeah. Because they got Emulex for $8 a share and then Broadcom for $17 billion in cash and $20 billion in shares.
Yeah, Broadcom was huge. Christmas. Mm.
Okay, bring it a little bit closer to home, guys. We have two acquisitions next up in line here. Piston Cloud being acquired by Cisco and IBM acquiring Box. Which one do we want to tackle first? Which one has the most potential for us? I think the Piston Cloud, right?
Actually, I think it would be Blue Box because...
Not Box, yeah, Blue Box.
It's not Box, it's Blue Box, yeah. Right? And so congrats to Jesse Proudman and the guys over at Blue Box because, you know, I saw those guys all at OpenStack Summit and, you know, they seemed like they were having a good time and I don't know if maybe they knew then. But, you know, it's a good fit for IBM because Blue Box was really focused on the managed services side of OpenStack. And it wasn't a distro player, you know, to the best of my knowledge. It was basically, you know, how do we get companies who don't normally have the skill set to implement an OpenStack environment in-house, how do we get them enabled and host that and manage it for them? And that's the kind of services arm that actually makes money right now in the OpenStack environment, more so than trying to sell a package distribution. And who better than IBM and their massive services arm to take the knowledge of that team and implement it much in the same way that Cisco is doing with MetaCloud.
So I'm sure the guys at Blue Box were very happy, you know, a few weeks ago when you were there together. But they couldn't afford to be too happy because could you imagine misbehaving and then having the deal fall apart because you got arrested?
Yeah, it happens to me all the time.
I don't think you pop this. I don't think you pop the corks until you actually ink the deal. So
yes,
yeah.
As long as the money's not in the bank, there's no deal.
I mean, do you remember when, was it, Instagram got bought for like $19 billion and the first picture the guys put up were, you know, like a case of Cristal?
Yeah, yeah.
On their Instagram page.
You can't buy champagne expensive enough for that occasion.
That's true.
What's Blue Box that someone else is not? Really, what's like, okay, this is definitely why IBM acquired them, and this is why someone else could have acquired them as well.
I mean, there are not a lot of players in the managed OpenStack space. So, you know, and not a lot of ones that had A, the longevity, B, you know, the skill set and, you know, the team behind that. They had something like 370 customers, which, you know, for a managed service provider of their size is actually pretty significant.
370 customers. Is that all the OpenStack customers?
No. Actually, you know what? I mean, you should go back and look. All right. We had
I'm sorry. I'm just joking.
You know, trust me. It's we're in that phase now where, you know, a lot of people who dismissed OpenStack as a concept or even something that could be marginally profitable, you know, there are going to be a hefty servings of crow, I think, in some respect, that need to be, you know, shoved into mouths at some point because it's.
Yeah.
I think it's a lot bigger than people want to take credit for it. Yes, it's still hard to get enabled. It's still hard to put forward, but it's 4 years old, and you know, give it a little bit more time before we write it off.
Yes. So, Piston Cloud acquired by Cisco.
Yes, smart.
Another OpenStack story, yeah.
Another OpenStack story. I mean, I think, you know, this one's a little bit different in terms of its scope. You know, I know some of the people that worked over there. So you have, you know, you had a very strong core OpenStack team over there. You had Gretchen Curtis. You had Josh McKenty. And we, you know, there's been a lot of people inside that organization that were very instrumental in the key foundation in building and crafting of OpenStack as a platform. And so they bring, you know, a huge amount of intellectual knowledge and capability going forward. And for, you know, for Cisco to pick that up, now they have a distro that they can work on that's, you know, has some backing and has been in the marketplace for a while. They have a customer base that's already established. They have, you know, established relationships with other vendors and whatnot. So if I'm Cisco and I want to, you know, have a packaged OpenStack distribution of my own to work with or to integrate with my cloud strategy around InterCloud Fabric or any of the other things that they're working on, that makes sense to me.
However, it does not look like Piston Cloud has the same number of customers. I've been on their website before, and I was on it earlier today, seeing who they list there, and they obviously don't list them all, but it's a kind of a funny collection.
Well, it's also a space where sometimes your customers don't want you to tell,
right.
Don't want you to have any forward facing or public facing collateral. Service providers, as a norm, they want to sell, yes, we do things, but we're not telling you who we do it with or what distribution we're running on or whose hardware we're running in the background. That's our, the economies of scale that they can reach and how fast they can implement things. All of those is like protected trade secret because, you have that second tier below the Googles of the world and the Amazons of the world who have to really watch. They're very, very highly competitive and have to be very agile in how they price things. And, anything that could slip out to give a competitor a competitive advantage against them is going to harm them. So it doesn't surprise me that, Piston Cloud doesn't have this giant NASCAR slide full of customers for the public.
So what is this going to do for Cisco themselves? What did they not have? Because I think they did already do a small acquisition in that area quite recently, right?
Well, no, because MetaCloud basically was just similar to Blue Box, right? They did managed OpenStack. You would go to MetaCloud and say, hey, I don't have necessarily the skills or the time to do OpenStack, but I want what it offers and affords me, and I will pay you every month to have it run on my premises or in a colo or something of that nature. So that's a different go-to-market operational model than having an actual group who is focused around services, APIs, and crafting kind of their own OpenStack deliverable as a turnkey solution and whatnot. So
this was a next necessary step.
I mean, I don't have any great insight into it, but it's definitely something that Cisco will be able to turn around and leverage as they start to push deeper into the OpenStack world. I mean, you look at HP; they have Helion. IBM obviously has a very large cloud arm that they're going forward with. So it's part of the natural condensing and collapsing of initial players in a space. They get, the smaller players get sucked up into the bigger ones, and then the ecosystem is overtaken by the giant vendors who are able to execute, right? Because, Piston Cloud probably can't go head-to-head against somebody like a Mirantis who has, or a Red Hat, one-on-one, but they can definitely go in there and win. And then with Cisco's backing, well, now they do. They have the financial wherewithal to be more competitive in that space. One question to me that I think is interesting is what does this do to the Red Hat-Cisco relationship? Because there's a pretty tight relationship there in terms of OpenStack deliverables, and I think that'll be interesting to see how that turns out. Maybe they're just picking up Piston Cloud for the internal talent and engineering team. I just don't know. I mean, it's all speculation at this point.
But do you think Cisco's got the sales talent and sales knowledge to be able to go and expand that business for Piston Cloud? And how fast are they going to have to fund an expansion of Piston Cloud's infrastructure?
I don't think they're going to have to worry so much about infrastructure. I think Cisco has that pretty much wrapped up.
It's a place to put servers, that's for sure.
In my respect or in my experience, and I worked for the service provider team inside Cisco, that team is very much well focused on being able to sell cloud technologies. It's not going to be a very tough spin for them because, they've already played in that space. They've been paying attention to that space for years now. They have a lot of internal tribal knowledge. I just don't think they haven't crafted a product yet. Maybe this allows them to craft the product that is Cisco software based. Capture the entire stack, right? If I go into an OEM partnership with somebody like that, let's point out Nutanix, for example, right? If I'm OEMing the software for them, I'm not going to get as much money selling it as a package solution as if I owned Nutanix outright. So the same thing can happen is if you want to sell a Cisco-powered, kind of like what HP Helion is doing, whatever Cisco wants to call it, packaged OpenStack solution, i.e. also qualified on all the Cisco hardware and enabled for all of the, you know, their software-defined networking around, you know, ACI and whatnot. You build massive deliverable engagements built on that stuff, and you control the entire chain of revenue that comes out of it. So, I mean, and when you look at it from that approach, it's a smart move.
Okay, interesting moves there on that side of Cisco. There are other sides of Cisco that have more challenging news. So we announced a couple of weeks ago, very recently, that Cisco CEO was going to change, and of course that trickles down into moving chairs, a chair dance, and this week Cisco lost three key people, and I think we can call them key people, which is Padmaresmi Warrior, CTO and strategist, Gary Moore, COO, and Rob Lloyd, president of development of sales. I mean, those are three. It was to be expected. A couple of people. It's a really big change of management on the highest level, but it's going fast, right?
It's a change of guard. I mean, this is very much like in the States, a new president, right? There's a little bit of shuffle. So I'm not surprised, but especially Padmaresmi Warrior was a really kind of profile person. And I've seen her speak, you know, honestly, I was even motivated just listening to her. So, you know, these are big shoes to fill. Cisco sells, right? Sales has, there's a change coming there. The strategy and CTO. These are big, big changes. So, to be determined, yet not necessarily totally out of the blue, but this is a big deal.
I think one of the things you say, it's change of the guards. It's what happens when a new president comes along. I mean, we haven't seen that kind of shift happening when Meg Whitman came on. But then again, the previous CEOs weren't that much as well at HP. So we've had chambers for two decades, so it could make sense that there's a big change.
We saw it. Let me give you an example where we did see something like that, and that's VMware. There was a time when Maritz was CEO, I could literally name CMO, Rick Jackson, CTO, Steve Harrod. I have no clue who it is now, right? There was a big change at the guard. Now, that was different. That wasn't all at once. That was, dare I say, an organic change of the guard. But we see these things happen. This is normal business at that level. There's a lot of interest. And honestly, Cisco's a big company. There's a lot of expectations there. So I have no real experience. In fact, only Mark knows big business, like from our experience. I guess Gabe with Cisco. But, you know, there's a lot of expectation there. But I'm not surprised, but you will have to see how it goes.
Would there be internal people lining up for these roles, or would Cisco be looking for external people to fill up these roles?
I think that the leadership knows what they want.
I would expect, I think, it to be a mixture of internal and external. You've also had other high-profile people leave recently as well, lower down the chain. What you're seeing is kind of, you know, it's the end of the John Chambers era. Obviously, you need to make changes. I mean, I believe Rob Lloyd was at Cisco for 21 years, and, you know, Moore was there for 14 years. That's, you know, they've gone through that whole transitional period of moving from, you know, massive acquisitions, conquering your networking enemies and coming out on top as the great destroyer, and then coming up forward now, you know, moving into UCS and compute. Now you're seeing Cisco transition into some other areas that are probably not naturally part of their wheelhouse. And so, you know, maybe you need new people to come in and do that. Obviously, you know, there's probably also some aspect of this is like, well, you know, for the longest time people thought Rob Lloyd was going to be the natural heir to the throne, and he was passed over by a subordinate. And so, you know, at some point you kind of like, well, you know what, I can go do something somewhere else, and maybe I can go lead some other company if it's not going to happen here.
They've got plenty of money. they don't have to work. They've been, if they've been at Cisco 20 years, 15 years, they've got a lot of stock options, especially at that level. Even though the stock's depressed, they can just walk away, right? You know, they're all there thinking that at some point the wheel of succession could turn to them. You know, and you know, to some degree, they're all thinking, you know, when John leaves, you know, I'll have an expanded role, you know, and there's an investment that's made, an emotional investment in preparing, you know, for something like that. And then when it happens and it's a guy underneath you in the organization, you know, really the lights just go on, the bells go off, and it's like, I guess it's time to go.
It's not like you're getting to run for office, right? I mean, you see it in the U.S. election right now. A bunch of people that, you know, really have no chance in hell of ever winning the election are running because they can. If you could run for CEO of the company, that would be interesting. It's just not the way it works. And so when you do have what we would consider regime change, like we just did with Cisco, you could expect a lot of people to be, a lot of deck chairs to shuffle.
Well, Mark, you hit it probably right on the head. These are all, everyone, especially at that level, when the chair dance starts, you're ready to either go along and for the next transition, or you're also ready to leave when it's probably not going to be your thing.
Exactly.
And you're right. These people have waited. What's going to happen? They've seen what happened. And there's probably a couple more that will say, well, this is not what I expected. This was, so let's go for plan B and find something else to do, or just leave entirely.
Right. Yeah. In Warrior's case, you know, she said maybe she'll go just be a, you know, board member on other companies. Who knows? You know, she's not even sure. She's not even sure what she's going to do. It's just like, well, it's obviously, you know, my time there is gone.
Or join a VC, right?
Steve Herrod route. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. Last part of the news, and we actually started a little bit with it. The NetApp conversation keeps on giving. This week, Mr. CEO, I'll say, quote unquote, steps down.
Yeah, Tom Georgians had been ineffective and had not been able to move the company or get it profitable and all of the things that, you know, are, you know, under his purview. He was not successful, and it was time for him to go. Probably time for him to go. 6 months ago or 12 months ago.
I think I said 3 years ago.
I think that's what you said on Twitter.
On Twitter, and I got some agreement. I mean, I think, you know, obviously, you know, the challenge for NetApp is that, you know, it's not 2009 and 2010, and the dynamic of the storage industry has changed drastically and much more rapidly than I think most of the entrenched legacy vendors have anticipated. And while I've seen NetApp do some neat and interesting things, primarily around some of the cloud aspects, you know, with Amazon, some of these others, it's been not enough to adjust and bring the additional profitability. And you've seen a 5-year downward slide of the revenue stream, and you've seen basically the growth of, you know, a dozen startups and mid-tier companies who have been, you know, taking over space where NetApp would have once dominated. It's not that the company is going away tomorrow. They're huge. They're still a very large player. They still have great products that lots of people like. It's just that the change of the landscape, they have not met that change fast enough. And I think also that, you know, putting all their eggs in the basket for the ONTAP basket was the wrong strategy to do, especially with all the headaches and the challenges in terms of how their customers had to upgrade and migrate to that platform, right?
That wasn't his decision, though. That decision was made before he came in.
Okay. Well, then, shows you what I know.
You know, well, no, I mean, you look at the acquisition of Spinnaker and how long it took him to do that and everything. That happened a long time ago. That was on Warmenhoven's watch.
But the acquisition happened a long time ago. But, you know, when you're the new CEO and you come on board and you're going to manage it, it's like you're the one that gets to dedicate and allocate the resources accordingly to get that project further along the line. What are we talking about, 10 years? To get that aligned? I mean...
Yeah, but, you know, so Georgians comes in the middle of that work. What's he supposed to do, derail it? You know, it's a really hard thing. And he was not a technology
right.
guy anyway. He was an operations guy, you know. And the whole thing about Georgians is, you know, he was going to, you know, really streamline the operations. I remember talking to Alex McDonald about it Alex was pretty high on him when he first came in. He thought, yeah, you know, this company really needs to get its act together and get serious about how the way it conducts business. But, you know, where they ended up losing was not having enough imagination, not enough moving forward in the technology. His operations strength sort of looks like they starved the technology. And, you know, to the point now where they've got about, what, $5 billion in the bank? They've got a lot of money. And so somebody could buy them, but what do they have that's promising looking forward is the question. Does anybody, and if they've got it, does anybody know about it? That's the hard thing, right? If they've got that tech, where is it? What is it? Does anyone know? Does anyone care? You know, they've got a lot of money. Great.
Challenging times ahead again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and I think that was mainly how the conversation online went as well on the LinkedIn group, is everyone that works for NetApp gets it. Everyone that doesn't get it. So they have a lot of challenges there. Maybe CEO can help.
Yeah, I think it could. You know, I don't think they're dead yet. I think they've got places to move. Certainly, you know, their entrenched competition is also having problems. Everyone's going through these kind of throes. The thing is right now all the growing companies, everybody is increasing their market share based, you know, on NetApp's install base. The storage business, you can always look at, you know, how fast is this market growing? And the newcomers always grow faster than the market does. So that means that the newcomers are eating into someone else. And usually it's a feeding frenzy that's going on somewhere. And it's NetApp's turn, right? It's been HP's turn in the past. You know, IBM's had a turn in the past. Everybody's had a turn, you know, being the thing that everybody else eats. And right now it's NetApp. And, you know, all the newcomers are feasting on NetApp's install base. And they've got to stop that and figure out how to get products that excite customers again.
Well, I mean, you know, and in that discussion, I think it's important. I mean, look at Demetrius's response, who runs Recovery Monkey. And I've been reading Demetrius's blog for 7 years. I mean, he's great. He's definitely dyed in the wool NetApp. And, you know, he does make some good points. I mean, you know, NetApp is still number two in the storage industry. So, it's in terms of market share that they have. It's not like they're going away. I just think that the general perception tends to be that as an organization, they have stumbled mightily over the last few years and that something needs to be done to right the ship or change direction. And, you know, getting rid of your CEO is probably one of those steps. Is it enough to change public opinion for those of us outside of NetApp? I don't know yet. We'll see. It remains on who, you know, it remains to be seen who comes on board and ultimately fills that position. If I remember correctly, the person they did bring on the board or bring on to be the CEO is also sitting on the board. So that's kind of an interesting dynamic in terms of what that role looks like and what that person's positioning is going to be. Because to be a board member and CEO is a much different animal than to be just one or the other.
I think that's a temporary slot.
Could very well be. And with that, guys, let's wrap it up for this week and for me for the next weeks and months to come. Thanks for this awesome journey. I will be listening every single week, yelling at my computer and what the hell are these guys talking about. Keep Nigel honest on that whole container thing. I cannot leave without pushing him. Okay. Good night, guys, and hear you all soon.